Hello and welcome to the EU and You. I'm Ellen Gunning, and in this series, I hope to explain the EU and its most important institutions. This week, I wanted to look at the whole area of agriculture and how the Parliament influences food policies. So I'm looking at issues like food labelling, GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and fisheries. I began by asking Eastern MEP Mairead McGuinness why she was a member of the Agriculture Committee.
The reason I'm on the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee is because of my background. I mean, I was involved very much in agriculture policy from a journalistic point of view, and I would have worked on RTE's agriculture and rural development programmes. But also I'm an agricultural economist by background. And what tends to happen here in the Parliament is that people come from very different specialities. So of the 700 plus members of this House, there are all sorts of different professions and backgrounds represented. And we would then almost be drawn magnetically towards our area of speciality. So in my case, it happens to be agriculture and rural development. But I'm also involved in the Environment Committee. I look after the Budgets Committee, and I take an interest in petitions. Now, you can't physically be involved in all of these committees at the same level. So MEPs take a conscious decision to focus on one committee in particular, and that's through my agriculture and rural development. It's
that
a really
sense.
Important time because we're now reforming agriculture policy. After 2013, we'll have a different type of policy. So important to be there now, but we can give time to other committees. The reason I look at budgets is because the agriculture policy is a significant part of the European Union's budget. So it's important to see what's going on there. And then the bit about environment and public health, well, everything to do with food production, environmental standards.
Ties back into the
back
environment.
And petitions, interestingly enough, was one of those I came onto in 2004, because that's where people, if you like, citizens from all over Europe come with their problems. It's a good gauge to see what's going on in the public mind.
So and those what kind of things are stressing people.
Yeah. Precisely. And I think that the system, even though it sounds, you know, how do people decide which committee, it actually works really well because it allows people, MEPs, to focus on areas where they have some knowledge, experience and an interest, and therefore can add to the public debate at a European level on the specifics of policy, and therefore.
And it also means that you work harder, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but the things that you're interested in, you read more about, you're naturally, you put more time into.
There is that,
than things
yeah.
that you're suffering with.
Tell me
what the Agriculture Committee is likely to do in the next 3 or 4 years. How will it impact? You said agriculture is going through this big review again. What are we likely to see either at a European level or at an Irish level in the next 4 or 5 years that we can say, oh, that was the Agriculture Committee in the EU?
Well, it's already started. This debate about what sort of agriculture policy we're going to have after 2013 is underway. And there was a time when people were saying, oh, do we need an agriculture policy? And what's really interesting to watch is how the mindset has evolved to where people are now saying, gosh, we absolutely do need an agriculture policy. We need it for consumers because they saw what happened when prices rose dramatically and caused huge problems, particularly for consumers who have a tight budget to live on and they want to know that they can have affordable and quality food. It's also important for producers because while we had a price hike, there then followed a price collapse. And producers saw if there was no policy, it could have been worse. And that would mean that producers lose out and consumers lose out. So this policy, and the reason why it's common and it's there for so long is because it covers everybody. It's a policy that guarantees us environmental protection in our rural areas. It provides food security, which is really, really important. It provides quality food produced in a way that's sensitive to animal welfare and environmental protection. What I see happening going forward is, if you like, a consolidation of the policy, a recognition that food is a public good. But there will also be, I think, further evolving of saying, look, we need to produce food in a sustainable way. So the environment is important, but it will become increasingly important.
And so, you know, the first challenge that we took was to produce quality food and get a standard across Europe.
Yes.
And the new challenge now.
The new challenge is food security. And I think what we need to get into our heads is I think we all take for granted that food arrives in our supermarkets. And I think there's now a recognition that, you know, there's an awful lot of things that can go wrong with the food chain if we ignore the needs of farmers to make an income. them and to have reasonable standards in how they operate, we could jeopardise Europeans' access to food produced in the European Union. And I think that would be quite horrific. What I also know from talking to consumers who are not farmers is that there's a huge, I suppose, grow is how I would describe it. But in Ireland, for example, people love the countryside and they do
like farmers.
They do. And they want to know what's going on there. And they have a sense in which that farmers get a low price for their produce and they're paying a high price for food. And they're asking, why is that going on?
Actually, that's an injustice that consumers are very conscious of.
Very
they don't
conscious
mind
of.
Paying a reasonable price for food, but they expect that that reasonable price will also be achieved by the farmer who's producing it.
And in recent times, the Commission have acknowledged that there's a malfunctioning food market. And this is a really big part of the debate about the future of agriculture policy. If we want farmers to look after the environment and provide the food, as we've discussed, they've got to be paid for that. And if the market isn't delivering a fair price, and we know it's not, then we need to look at how the public policy can deliver it. But the Commission have taken a step, which in my view is one of the most significant steps I've seen in my term here. They've now acknowledged that the food market doesn't work properly and they're looking at ways of intervening in it to ensure that consumers and producers, small producers and small farmers and others in the chain get a fair crack of the whip. The word fairness has now been embedded into this policy and I think that's a major development.
And when you said that part of what you're trying to do is secure, make sure that people who operate within the EU, citizens of the EU, actually have access to EU food. Is it likely, if there wasn't an agricultural policy, that all of our food would be imported from outside of the EU?
Well, even if you look at the policy we have, Europe imports vast amounts of food. For example, beef. The European Union doesn't produce enough beef. We actually import quantities of beef. So we have already evolved to a situation of being surplus. And many will remember the bad old days of too much food, butter mountains and beef. But that's completely gone. I mean, it is extraordinary how we have come to a stage where we now are in, if you like, deficit in some of the major commodities. What is very important, I believe, for Europe strategically is that we use our land base effectively and efficiently and that we do produce food in the European Union. Now, I'm battling on this one because not everybody agrees with me. Some people think, oh, sure, it doesn't matter whether Europe produces food. If we produce cars and we trade off and bring in food from elsewhere, isn't that fine? I don't think so. I think food is a public good. I think our citizens want to know where their food comes from and they want it to be produced in the European Union where we can do that. So that's why it's important that the public are involved in this debate. It's not just a debate about farmers and the countryside. It's a much, much bigger debate.
Eastern MEP Lee Aylward agrees. Agriculture policy is about much more than farmers and the countryside. It's also about the consumer.
Well, unfortunately, I suppose we've always sold the Common Agriculture Policy as a support for farmers rather than, and I've made this point very, very strongly in the review of the Common Agriculture Policy, which is taking place at the present time, that CAP has been equally important to the consumer. And what happens is over the years, we have subsidised farmers to produce good quality food at much lower cost. And as a result of that, the housewife going into the supermarket is paying proportionally far less today than she was paying 20 years ago, for example. And I think that has been one of the great successes of CAP. We've also introduced high quality, I think is very important from that point of view, and consistency in food. So therefore, it has been as important for the consumer as it has been for the farmer.
Naturally, that's a heck of an achievement, though, that the food quality has improved and the cost of the consumer has gone down at the same time. That's a heck of an achievement.
Well, I think if you talk to any farmer, he'll tell you the price that he gets at his farmyard gate today is probably the equivalent of as it was 15 years ago. The price of an animal or the price of a product.
Okay, so His take hasn't increased.
His profit has dropped significantly. His price has dropped significantly. But the payment that comes, the 1.8 billion euro that we all hear about every year, 1.3 billion goes to the farmer. Well, that's a direct payment to produce the food. But to obviously the end result is that you have a lower price, lower cost.
So the consumer, the big benefit of CAP to the consumer in terms of food is better quality, lower cost.
Well, of course, it benefits both. There's no use in saying that the farmer benefits over getting the payment. There's no use in denying that. But the consumer is a huge winner at the end of the day as well. And our big argument would be at the moment, you know, the farmer is very dissatisfied with what he gets at the farmyard gate, even with his single farm payment. The consumer still pays a significant amount, although far less proportionally. But somewhere in the middle, that's our great problem at the moment. There's a serious profit being made. And that's one of the issues that we're trying to deal with now here in the Parliament. And, you know, some people will say it's the processor. Others will say it's the supermarkets and these that are ripping it off someplace in the middle.
Yep.
All will argue the other way. But there's no doubt in my mind that what the farmer gets at the gate and what the consumer pays at the shelf, that there's a significant difference there, and we must get to the bottom of that.
It's a very interesting one, because wasn't it Hilda Tweedy when she formed the Irish Housewives Association? My God, that's 40, 50 years ago. I remember seeing an interview with her, and she said that her problem was that she didn't mind paying for food, but when she looked at what, at that stage, farmers were being paid for their food, she didn't understand why she was paying so much and they were getting so little. And it's really what you're trying to do is equalise it and say the consumer is prepared to pay a fair price, the farmer is prepared to produce at a fair price, but really it's looking at the fellow in the middle who's depriving them both to a certain extent.
What we really need here is far greater transparency, and that's what we haven't got. And that's the approach from the Commission and the Parliament here at the present time. We would like to see a monthly account of price fixing and price structures. We haven't got that at the moment, and I think we should also maybe look at the possibility of appointing an ombudsman. They're looking at that in Great Britain at the present time to keep a balance and check on these things, because there's no doubt in my mind that in between the price rises significantly and it's of no benefit to what it originally was intended to be, for to give the farmer a decent living, the family farm in particular, but the consumer protected at the other side. But I don't want to go away from the fact that we have the quality. That's very, very important. I think the quality of food today and the consistency of that quality is excellent and better than anything else in the world.
And can I pick you up on the quality a bit? Because one of the things that affects quality is this whole issue of GMOs, of genetically modified food. Europe has been very hot on not allowing any genetic modification to foods, really, while you're establishing for yourselves whether or not you're happy with it. But you were pointing out an anomaly when I last met you about how you can actually import foods into Europe that do contain GMOs, which didn't seem to make an awful lot of sense to me. Can you tell me a little bit more about what's going on there?
Well, I think we have to look at the background of this first. You know, we impose very serious standards on our farmers in Ireland and Europe. The same doesn't apply to other countries, people exporting into Europe. Now, in our case in Ireland, it's vitally important because we export 80% of everything, 80% plus, in fact, of everything. That's beef, dairy products, pig meat, whatever it might be. So therefore, we have to have an advantage over other countries. And we sell the green image, and we also sell the fact that we do not use genetically modified organisms in our food production. Now, it's actually in the programme for government that we will be a GMO-free growing area. There's no doubt whatsoever about that. That is our programme for government. The problem is that we import, as I said, from other countries where the product is produced with GMs. Now, we have another problem that in order to feed our animals, we ban meat and bone meal for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we must have supplements, and we import soya beans from the United States, which are genetically modified. And they go as a supplement into our foodstuff, our cereals back at home to feed our animals, whatever we use it for. And it's a great problem with that at the moment because...
Well, that will affect our GMO-free status.
No, not because the sciences say that in animal feed you can allow a component part. That's
okay,
acceptable.
Provided it's a certain percentage or whatever.
And we use less than about 10%, I think, is the figure where we do use it. But it has to be approved on a case-by-case basis by the European Food Safety Authority and by the Council of Ministers. So it might take 2 years, in fact, to approve a particular component part. And that's creating great difficulties for the people supplying feedstuff to animals at home. Now, let me say that under no circumstances would we tolerate human feed. It's animal feedstuff as a component part.
Yes, it's not coming into the human food chain in any way at all.
Absolutely. And
it's very controlled percentage-wise in terms of what goes into the animal food chain.
And the sciences will also say that if you feed an animal with a percentage of this in the feedstuff, that it will not transfer to the meat or the milk, for example. But on the other hand, then, there are those that would argue that DNA would show that there is a trace of that. So it depends on which side of the argument you're coming from.
And if you're
but we are being very careful.
If you're taking in this product which goes in as part of the feed, is the problem that the people who are selling it can't actually sell it because it hasn't been approved by Europe, it hasn't gone through the loop? Or is it that possibly in 2 or 3 years' time somebody might be told the product that you were using in good faith didn't pass the European standard?
Yeah, well, we also have the option in Ireland because labelling would take care of that in the Parliament. We're voting on that very issue. For labelling, if there is a the slightest trace of GMOs in the feedstuff, that it will be labelled as such, so people will have the option of buying.
Food labelling is about much more than things that we've become used to, like contains traces of nuts. I asked Nessa Childers, MEP, why is food labelling actually important at all?
Well, I think people have become very, very keen to know what they're eating. That's one of the reasons, and this is why this regulation has been on the table here in Brussels. Health has a lot to do with it. We have, for instance, a very, very serious obesity crisis in most of the countries of the European Union, but particularly in the north of Europe. And the idea of this was to actually develop systems whereby people could see very clearly, and these would be mandatory on the labelling of prepackaged foods, not simple foods, but prepackaged foods, for instance, how many calories were in it, how many fats, sugar and salt. Salt, for instance, in itself, why people may not realise it is, you know, you could save, according to the Irish Heart Foundation, 2,000 lives a year. From reducing salt intake.
That's a huge number.
Well, yes, because of the question of stroke, of the relationship of salt.
So I'm not the only person in Ireland who salts everything, even though there's enough salt on it. Is it something that's peculiar to Ireland? Do we take a lot of salt?
Well, no, we don't. But this would be a European-wide problem, probably in some Asian countries too, where their food is quite salty. But as you know, it raises blood pressure, and these are serious issues. Obesity is even more serious. A very large percentage of people are now overweight in Ireland and in other European countries. So what we want to do is to put more things on food labels to make it easier for people to know what they're eating. I in particular wanted colour coding on
food.
Oh,
I love the idea of colour coding.
But it didn't pass.
So are we going to be left looking at, because it never makes sense to me that I have to read a whole load of information on the back. I know, I'm sure I should, but I don't buy that many packets anyway, but it drives me insane that I have to read everything and then almost become a scientist to discover, well, are they good fats or bad fats, or, you know, is that proportion right? So the colour coding didn't pass. I'm really sorry to hear that, because that would have been a super idea.
No, it didn't pass, and we have a guideline daily amounts instead with percentages, which I don't think is sufficient, because remember, people are shopping very quickly, they're going through shops very quickly, and they need to know what's in food before they buy it at a reasonable speed. And not only that, some of the retailers who already have colour coding will tell you, in a way, something that I probably hadn't realised, is that some of the people that we would be buying this food may not be able to read very well. But I think there was a lot of lobbying and things by the food industry who didn't want this, and really they succeeded. Now, some retailers do have already traffic light systems. They have Marks and Spencers and Aldi, for instance. Not Aldi. The other one beginning with
Lidl.
Asda have colour coding systems. Under this regulation that's gone through the first reading, in fact, they may not be allowed to keep them. Now, this directive has to go to council. It has to go to the Council of Ministers, and I think that may be changed by the council, because I think possibly the retailers that are using colour coding may not be too pleased with the idea that they could be forced to remove it.
Well, when they've been so proactive and they actually introduced it in the first instance, how realistic is it going to be from a citizen's point of view? It means that I can go in and buy a packet or a tin of something, and by law now, if this passes, it will have to say what the contents are in terms of percentages of daily use.
It will, yes. And it'll have to say where the food comes from. That did go through a lot of useful things. Country of origin, not just for beef, for instance, but for chicken and fish, for poultry and fish.
But for all the things that are kind of sliding under the bar at the moment.
We'll have to go through. Alcohol got out of the whole thing as well. It got a kind of derogation from it.
It doesn't really matter where your alcohol is
again, under
from.
Under influence of various industries. I consider that to be quite serious. As well, because
Before we deal with the alcohol, tell me, if I buy packets and jars that have food labelling on it, I still don't know if I go into, I'm not picking on McDonald's, but if I go into somewhere for a burger or I eat a meal out, I still don't have any way of knowing if it looks healthy. You know, the way that the thing that always catches me is somebody says, I ate a salad, it was very healthy. And then you say, but you had all these croutons on it and you had all this salad dressing and it actually wasn't nearly
as
healthy as you thought it was.
Well, I think if you go into McDonald's, they've made efforts now to put things like salads on their menu. And
but
you
there still isn't an EU
no, there
system
isn't.
For it.
And I myself get quite frustrated in restaurants. I mean, some restaurants now are putting low fat LF on their menus. You notice it in Ireland as well. And I like that because I have no idea what I'm eating. And I'm somebody that actually really does need to know what they're eating. I'm not what you'd call naturally thin.
Neither
and
am I.
I would, but market forces come in here, though. People will gradually, for instance, they will flock to retailers that have, if they want them, have the colour coding. They will go into restaurants where they have some idea of what they're eating. I noticed Domino's pizzas, for instance, and some of the other takeaway pizzas have the calories now on their pizzas in some places.
That's a big addition. So you can, let me just before we close, let me just ask you, why did you think that the alcohol, it was important that alcohol slid through and that we should know where our alcohol is coming from?
We should know what the calorie content of it. That's what we wanted, many of us, is. I mean, you know that, you know, wine and beer is quite high in calories, and I'd at least like to know what it is that I'm drinking.
When is it likely to be decided?
Well, the second decision, it'll be a number of months before it goes to the council. And then it could
and
be stuck
the
there. There could be
final.
Then it goes to a second reading of the Parliament.
So it'll be next year or the year after before we actually see it.
Yeah, it would have been 3 years anyway, even if it would be about 3 years before we actually see it.
Finally, on this whistle-stop tour of food issues, I wanted to have a quick look at the seas around Ireland.
It's been said by quite a few people that when Ireland negotiated entry into the EU, we were very conscious of our farming and probably not so conscious of our fishing. We're an island nation, so fisheries really are at the top of our agenda. Pat Cope-Gallagher, tell me, we've changed our perspective on fisheries. We seem to be much more conscious of the resource that we have in our seas. What has the EU been doing in terms of fisheries for Ireland and what's the future?
Well, to look at the backdrop, first of all, when we joined Union 1973 and we were part of the Common Fisheries Policy in 1983, I firmly believe that we didn't get a good deal at the time. And it's not necessarily a reflection on those who negotiated back in those years. We weren't as developed as we are today. We're much more developed and we still have to take the same percentage of the overall cake. However, during this mandate, we will have an opportunity of reviewing the Common Fisheries Policy. There have been reviews in the past, I've been here in the past, and we got very little benefit from this. The former commissioner stated very clearly that everything would be on the table. The present commissioner, Madam Damanaki, has said the same. So we have now made a submission to the commission. They launched their green paper last year. The government have made a submission. I made a submission together with my colleagues. And we would hope that there could be some changes that would be of benefit to Ireland, much more so than we achieved during the last 30 years.
Well, so you said that fisheries has actually developed, that when we came in, it wasn't really developed, so maybe it wasn't to the top of the agenda. What kind of things are you looking for now? What kind of changes are you looking for now?
We're looking for a greater percentage of the overall quota. We have much larger vessels than we had in 1973 and 1983. We have, one could say, the most prolific fishing grounds in Europe, whereas at the same time, we're only allowed to catch a small percentage of those. So we will be asking the Commission to take into consideration the socio-economic factors in addition to other factors which were considered then. We will ask the Commission as well to look at this from a regional basis. It's one size fits all in relation to European fisheries regulation. If there's an issue in the south of Spain or the south of Greece or the northwest of Ireland, it's the one set of rules that govern this. So now in the review of the Common Fisheries Policy, we do believe that the Commission will look at this from from a regional perspective, not renationalisation because that won't happen, but if there is an issue of the Northwest, whether it's Ireland, Scotland, England, or indeed going right up into the North Sea, then it should be dealt with at that level and not at an entire European level. They could make the recommendations and the European Commission and the Council could then take decisions.
So is there almost a case for dividing fisheries into regions at the moment so that each region could recommend on what's relevant to its region, except not by country, but by location?
There's a very strong case for that type of regionalisation. And I do believe that there's goodwill there on the part of the Commissioner and consequently, I would hope, on the part of the Commission and that we could pursue that.
And what about you were saying that you were also hoping for a greater percentage of the quota? Just looking at a map, it would seem that we should have quite a lot of the quota since we are the island nation on the most extreme west. What are you hoping for an increase from too?
Well, that may be a tall order. We've tried over the years to get a greater percentage and of course that's not happening. But we will make a further effort this time. But if we have to get a larger share of the cake, then other countries will have to forfeit somewhat, and I can't see them doing that. But what is happening at the moment, there's a constant improvement in the stock levels because of the realistic and responsible attitude being adopted by the fishermen in partnership with the Council and the Commission. So even if we can increase the cake, it will still give us, in tonnage terms, a greater amount, if not a greater share.
And finally, can I ask you the one that I'm conscious of, because I don't have any fishing background at all, but everybody talks about the fact that if you're allowed a particular quota for fish, that if fishermen catch other fish in their nets, they actually have to throw those fish back, which results in sort of dead fish going back into the water. Are you looking at that issue at all?
We're concentrating on what's known as discards. And I think it's very wrong that the fish should have to go back into the water. But if the fish are taken ashore, even if they're not good quality, it means that they're taken out of the quota and they will be penalised. So in order to overcome the problem of discards, I believe that fishermen should be incentivised to take these ashore, and they could be compensated for this without taking them out of the quota which were allowed. So discards is a big issue. Discards, I would hope, would be very integral to the new common fisheries policies, but it is a major issue.
I think it's something that people broadly would support purely because the idea of wasting food in this day and age just seems like a madness. Pat the Cope Gallagher, I could talk to you about fisheries for hours. Thank you for joining me today.
Okay, thanks, Ellen.
You've been listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This series was presented and produced by Ellen Gunning. Sound engineering was by David O'Grady. The series was made with the assistance of the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative.